Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,500 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Julie Pottaker, and she is author of Snap, From Chaos to Calm. Mindfulness is purposely paying attention to the present moment without judgment. And research shows that it can reduce stress, improve sleep, and enhance emotional regulation. Julie shares how anyone can calm stress quickly with her SNAP method, evidence-based mindfulness practices that are easy to learn, remember, and use anywhere, even in the heat of the moment. Julie Pottaker is a mindfulness expert with extensive certifications and teacher training in a variety of tools and methods, including mindfulness self-compassion. Her latest book, Snap, From Chaos to Calm, and through her Mindfulness Methods for Life program offerings, Julie helps others bring more peace and wellness into their lives. Snap, as well as Julie's first book, Life Falls Apart, But You Don't Have to, Mindful Methods for Staying Calm in the Midst of Chaos, are now available on audiobook. For more information, you can visit Julie's website, which is www.mindfulmethodsforlife.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Julie to the show. Good day, Julie.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. And, you know, mindfulness is a topic that I can't get enough of, and I've been sharing with individuals because it's such an important practice, and people need to be reminded and also approached from different, you know, points of view. So I'm really excited about today's conversation. Now, you first came to learn about mindfulness from a doctor who recommended it after you came in showing severe stress symptoms. So take us back to that point. Tell us what happened.
I had three teenagers who are now thankfully alive and grown. but at the time, I had three teenagers. All three were ADHD kids, so school was really hectic. And my parents had moved to town, and they were experiencing some medical issues, and I was just that classic sandwich generation. Mm-hmm. And my words started garbling coming out of my mouth. So I would think one word, and what would come out of my mouth was a different word. And I got nervous that something really was wrong with my brain. So I went to a neurologist, and he did all the brain scans and the interviewing. And when we were all done with the analysis of my brain, he diagnosed me with stress. Thank God. It was stress and not a glioblastoma or something horrendous, right? So he recommended mindfulness-based stress reduction, a class that was created by Jon Kabat-Zinn in 1979. Full circle, I'm now a UCSD Center for Mindfulness teacher. But back then, I was just a novice, raw, stressed-out mom, and MBSR really helped me. And then because I took MBSR, I was on the email list of the Center for Mindfulness. So when a new class was created called Mindful Self-Compassion, I got an email. We've got this new curriculum. It was created by Chris Germer and Kristen Neff. And so I took it, and that was the class that was profound for me, profound healing. And in the interim, I was taking brain science classes because the whole idea that something that you're doing can help your brain is miraculous to me. Something that you're voluntarily doing and practicing and it's not medicine can really have a profound impact on your brain and by extension, your entire body. I mean, that's a big, big deal. So after I took Mindful Self-Compassion, And I practiced daily, and I still do, by the way. That was 2010. In 2014, which is already 11 years ago, they advertised that they were going to do a teacher training for mindful self-compassion, and that Chris Germer and Kristen Neff were going to be doing the training alongside some of the excellent teachers from UCSD Center for Mindfulness, and it was going to be in Petaluma, California, at a retreat center. And I applied, and I was accepted. And so there were 52 of us, 49 therapists, me, a recovering lawyer, a physical therapist. So it was actually 50 therapists, me and a physical therapist. And so that made up the very first cohort of mindful self-compassion teachers, and I started teaching it right away. And then eventually adapted it and, you know, wrote books and that kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the story there. That's a long, long answer for a short question.
Well, that's good, because it's always nice to know what in the journey of an individual, or, you know, kind of where they came from, where something significant began, and the path taken to get to where you are today. So.
Yeah.
So
I mean,
now,
since that time, I've taken so many other trainings, because anytime something comes up on my radar that looks like it's adjacent but could be super helpful, I'll do it. And then I'm able to synthesize all those trainings into sort of like a greatest hits.
Yeah. Well, you're adding tools to the toolbox, you know, to be able to pull out what you need when you need. So now, you mentioned a little bit about science, you know, and I believe there is a lot of good science behind how mindfulness affects the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So can you explain a little bit about that scientific view of the ability to, I guess, rewire our brain?
Sure. I'm happy to. So we are primates, right? So what we are wired to do is worry and ruminate. We're always time traveling to the past and to the future. Our brain is trying to keep us safe. But in today's day and age, all that worrying and ruminating can make us sick. It causes cortisol and adrenaline. We feel activated. It's the most primitive part of our brain, the amygdala. When we feel activated, that is activated. And in order to calm down and downregulate all those cortisol and adrenaline stress hormones, there's things that we can do to downregulate that and cause endorphins and cause oxytocin to help us feel grounded and connected and back to baseline, tend and befriend. And then there's tons of mindfulness and daily life activities that can help us calm down. Anything from grounding through the soles of your feet, or using like an object, like a here and now stone or a mala or a rosary to collect your attention and focus it on it, or doing a sense and savor walk out in nature, or having a mindful few sips of your coffee in the morning or tea, or mindful eating. You know, there's a slew of those things. And then there's SNAP, which I created, which starts with soothing touch. So if you put your hands on your body where you find it soothing, whether you've got two hands on your heart, two hands on your belly, a hand on your heart, a hand on your belly, you're cradling your face, you're hugging your arms, you just have one hand lovingly in the other, what's going to happen is oxytocin and endorphins are going to get released from your brain into your body, because it's the mammalian caregiver response, where when an infant cries out and gets picked up, those feel-good hormones get released in the infant and in the adult. So we don't need another human to do that for us. We can do that for ourselves. So that's, I think that's like unbelievably cool. So we're calming ourselves down. I've got both hands on my heart right now. That's the S in SNAP for soothing touch. And then the N is name the emotion. You've probably heard name it to tame it. You're naming it. Oh, I feel anxiety. I feel fear. I feel whatever it is. And then the act is, what do I need to hear right now? And what do I need to do to shift my mood? So what do I need to hear right now? Julie, you're safe. Nobody's chasing you. You're sitting in your office. Your door is closed. You're talking to a nice guy on the phone. Everything's fine. And then what do I want to do to shift my mood? That's the most glorious bespoke thing. That is your toolbox. So you might have 45 things in there. You might, if you're driving in your car, you can't take a bath, but you could do breath work, or you could put on Carole King radio. You could call a friend. You know, there's so many things that you could do to shift your mood. And then the P is praise, where you thank your practice, thank your teachers, thank yourself, thank your deity of choice if you're a religious person. And that slides you right into the gratitude practice, which I highly recommend everybody participate in, because for the past, I don't know, 60 years or something, gratitude has been shown to really help people feel good, to really help mental health and well-being in all areas of people's lives.
Yeah. That, you know, when it comes to gratitude, I found that it is so important to put emotion behind it, you know, in the sense that, you know, you really feel gratitude rather than give it lip service. In one of my books, I did It's No Secret, Spirituality Bites, which I kind of bring through some of the things that guests have talked about. And one of those chapters was called You Ungrateful So-and-So. you know, it was basically a look at gratitude, you know, and that gratitude shouldn't be looking for some kind of payment in return.
Okay, so you said just a couple different things there that are really important in terms of brain science. So when you have a positive mood, which usually you do when you're writing down what you were grateful for that day because you're thinking about it, not just giving it lip service, if you enrich it and absorb it in your body for a dozen seconds, you're creating a new neural network. So you're pushing a neural state to a neural trait. So you want to be always doing these happy bridges, because the more happy bridges you have in your brain, the negative ones get pruned out. And then you end up with a wandering mind when your mind is wandering, that's less scary, that's less ruminating, that's less worrying. You end up more peaceful, because you have used experience-dependent neuroplasticity training to rewire your brain for happiness and resilience. And we have to shout out to Rick Hansen for all that work.
Okay, well, that's good. Boy, neural date to neural trait.
You want to go from state to trait. So if you're having something happy happen, don't waste it. You want it to imprint on your brain. So what wires together, fires together. So you want to feel it. So how I teach that is, that's a beautiful sunset. What's for dinner? No, that's a beautiful sunset. Oh, look at those colors. And then spend a few moments feeling that awe from the top of your head to the bottom of your toes. And bingo, you've created a happy bridge.
Okay, good. That's good advice. Good to take. Now, as you indicated, you've been studying and practicing and teaching mindfulness for quite some time. So what led you to write this new book, Snap from Chaos to Calm?
Well, I was teaching a practice called RAIN, which is recognize, allow, investigate, nourish. And that actually is not in the Mindful Self-Compassion curriculum, but it was popularized by Tara Brach. She teaches it really well. And it wasn't invented by her. It was invented in the 80s, and I really should have the name of the person on the tip of my tongue. Her name's Wendy, and I'm so sorry I can't think of her last name, because I'd like her to get credit for RAIN, because people are still teaching RAIN. Anyway, I was front-loading that acronym with soothing touch, and during the pandemic, it came to me that it needed an update because I was adapting it while I was teaching it. And then I just came up with SNAP. I just literally, it was like a SNAP decision. I came up with SNAP, and then I started teaching it right away. And, you know, I put it on the Teacher Cafe for the Mindful Self-Compassion teachers, and I started teaching it on Zoom in my classes when I was teaching, and people really liked it. And then I read this book about how our brains learn, and so I created, like, dance moves, hand and arm movements to go with SNAP while I taught it so that people would have these neuro-linguistic hooks so that they remember it. And then once they integrated it into their practice, they wouldn't need to do the dance moves, but it really helped people. So when I did the book launch, I had people snapping their fingers and then soothing touch, name the emotion, act and praise with their hands doing these motions, and then I had them turn to the left, turn to the right, turn to the back of the room, sit down, stand up, sit down. And I remember afterwards, my husband said it was kind of like the hokey pokey. And I said, that's awesome because people remember the hokey pokey. Like, I want people to remember this so that they have it and can use it whenever they feel activated by anything.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know. And when you have multiple ways of conveying a topic, sensory types of things, like not only hearing it, but you see, you move, you know, that reinforces the idea very much for some people who learn differently.
Right. Oh, there's so many different kinds of learners, my goodness. I mean, my husband and all three of my children. I have no idea when I married a guy who I knew, because we started dating in 1980, I knew he had ABD. I mean, he told me the stories of how he couldn't read until they put him on Ritalin, and then he jumped four grades, right, in terms of reading comprehension. So, I mean, I knew all that, but I didn't imagine what it would be like to be a mom of kids that needed all these different learning learning methods. I remember when my son was a little boy, I would have a timer and he'd do his homework for 5 or 7 minutes. And then we would jump up and run around the table or play a silly instrument and then sit down and then do another chunk. I mean, what a pain in the butt.
Yeah. But, you know, that's working with your child's capacity.
Right. Yeah. And the twins were so cute. We would go to, an event at school and all the other kids were participating. They'd be like, you'd see their little faces singing or their hands and arms doing what their hands and arms were supposed to do. And my little daughters were always sort of looking out into space.
Yeah.
Like, okay. All righty.
Oh, goodness.
And now they're both phenomenally talented musicians, singer-songwriters. So I think a lot of super creative people have neurodiverse brains.
Yeah, I agree. And it all comes from looking at life from a different perspective.
Totally.
Yeah. So now the SNAP strategies can be used when coping with anger, anxiety.
Anything.
Yeah, sadness, depression, shame, guilt, political strife, or disaster. Yeah, that's like everything. All of those negative events or emotions that can be debilitating. So,
Right. So
with that, and addressing any of those, you indicate that starting with self-compassion and soothing touch is where it all starts.
Right, and you're doing that, so there's this conversation that people get into in the mindfulness world where they say you shouldn't spiritually bypass, you shouldn't make yourself feel better right away because those negative states, and they don't even want to call them negative, but those emotions that are arising that make you feel bad, you should take the time to sit with those feelings to figure out, you know, because they have information for you. So, but my point of view is, of course, I agree, of course, but you don't need to feel bad all day long. You can allow yourself to feel bad for a while and then choose to make the shift. Now, if you choose to feel bad all day long, that's your choice, and I wouldn't beat yourself up over it. But I personally used to be a depressed woman. I haven't suffered any depression. Of course, I get stressed. I get blue just like normal people. I mean, all you have to do is check the news out and it could really take you down, right? But I don't choose to be incapacitated anymore. I don't choose to, you know, stick my head in the oven or the toilet or wherever else.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's a good point, is that, you know, there's a difference between, you know, experiencing even for a short period of time to try and understand, you know, what in a particular emotion is popping up, but also to make sure that it doesn't negatively impact your life.
Right. So I took, this is why the intro is so weird for me. It says other trainings, because I couldn't, you wouldn't want to list all the trainings. It would be weird. But I'm an advanced trauma-sensitive mindfulness teacher from David Treleaven's trainings. And why am I telling you this? You said something just now that picked that up. And it's your window of tolerance. Okay. So, yeah, that's what you said. So when you're incapacitated, it's because you fell off of your window of tolerance. You got flooded by emotion that you couldn't handle. So I teach how not to fall out of your window of tolerance and how not to be like hyper aroused or hypo aroused. So you know, if you have people in front of you in a classroom and you're not on Zoom, there's like visual cues that you can see if somebody sort of looks out of it and they're slumped over, that they might have disassociated because they fell out of their window of tolerance. It was just too much for them. So there's scripting that you can use when you're guiding meditations to try to protect people so that if they feel flooded, they kind of intellectually visualize closing their heart so that their heart's not so open that they get flooded, so they can open their eyes if they were closed, stand up, leave the room, get some water, stop the practice. You know, nobody should, so meditation teachers should all be aware that in any group of people, 80% of them have had some kind of trauma. And then the scripting around what they're teaching and what's coming out of their mouth when they're leading meditation should give people all kinds of allowances. Keep your eyes open, just look down in your lap, you know, put your back to the wall, face the door, whatever it is, and let people know that the most important thing is them taking care of their own selves. So if they notice that they're starting to feel really uncomfortable, just stop doing it.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know. I mean, it's, you know, I didn't realize that at any one moment, 80% of a population would have experienced trauma. But again,
isn't that crazy? It's so true. Yeah. And it's so wild.
Yeah. And I guess there's so many things that could fall into the trauma, even if it's a death in the family, which we all experience. So, well, that's important for mindfulness teachers to keep in mind.
And it's also, I think, helpful, like, for your listeners, if some of them have experienced trauma, to know that they're not alone, that trauma is actually more of a usual, typical state once you're alive on the planet for a little while, because some things are really traumatic for one person and wouldn't be for another. For instance, the death of a grandparent, like you just mentioned before, a death in the family. I mean, some humans develop trauma from that, and they can even develop PTSD or complex PTSD from something that another person's nervous system could have handled and could have integrated.
Yeah, it is a very subjective experience for people. Mm-hmm.
And it's embodied, right? So having a somatic, sensitive therapist to work through trauma, or even doing grief yoga. When I did the grief certification training to be a grief educator with David Kessler, one of the guests that they had was a grief yoga specialist, and he led us through a series of these motions to, like, move the energy of grief out of your body. And I thought, wow, that's fascinating.
That is very much. Just, again, goes to show there are so many different ways of being able to, getting healthier. So,
yeah.
Now, most of us have heard of the term inner critic and are too familiar with that nagging inner voice, which I know very well. In your book, your first book, you recommend calling yourself sweetie or some other term of endearment, but you have a more colorful term for that critic. So what is it?
Am I allowed to swear on your
Yes, you
show?
Can. Yes, you can. That's the beauty of not being broadcast.
Okay, I call my inner critic my inner bitch.
Okay.
And I've actually made really good friends with her, and she pretty much is quiet now. There's a writing exercise that I teach that comes from Internal Family Systems, which was created by Dr. Schwartz, Richard Schwartz, and the exercise has you think of kind of a minor character trait that you'd like to change, and you write a letter to yourself from your inner critic voice, and it's pretty harsh, the tone of voice and the language, and then you try to find your compassionate voice, and that's the voice that you would use if a dear friend had the same issue, and it's the advice you'd give to the dear friend, and you internalize that as your inner compassionate voice. And then you go further and you write a letter that's a bigger deal, you know, a big, huge thing in your life. And I actually, in my first book, I published it, which all these years later, I'm like, was that a good idea? But anyway, yeah. I did. Just to show people how it works. And I remember, because my mind dealt with parenting, and it was really something that was troubling me. And I remember I took it into my therapist, and she said, she got tears in her eyes. She's like, oh, my goodness, you wrote this about yourself. You said these nice things about yourself. She was so moved and so touched by how much farther I had come along, how much farther outside of talk therapy. It was the mindful self-compassion curriculum that really healed me, and it was because I put my all into it. Mm-hmm. And that was before I was ever a mindful self-compassion teacher, but that's the way I became one.
Okay. Now, regarding compassion, one of the things you suggest is that we put ourselves out into the world, letting our hearts radiate love outward. And it's something that you call bust your bra.
Yeah.
Favorite thing. Now, I have to admit, I have never heard of that.
Well, it doesn't work for guys, right? Unless they, some guys wear bras. Yeah. Anyway, no, so the feeling that you get when you're radiating love, when you're wishing people well, when you're standing at TSA waiting to go through security at the airport, and you're looking at all the strangers' heads, and you're saying to the back of their heads, may you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. And you do it in the grocery store when you're waiting in the checkout line, and you just live your life this way, constantly wishing others well. You can feel energy coming from your chest. So that was sort of a tongue-in-cheek bust your bra moment. But I can tell you, when I had the book launch at our local bookstore in La Jolla, California, part of San Diego, it's a independent bookstore named Warwick's. When I had the book launch for the first book, Life Falls Apart, But You Don't Have To, there were 95 people. It was standing room only in the back. And I just was like, I had like a fire hose of love shooting out for me, and it was all coming back to me. It was just this palpable, gorgeous, gorgeous feeling. And I use that whenever I find my mood dipping. Going back to experience-dependent neuroplasticity training, you can call up a memory, re-enrich it, absorb it, like visualizing it, and step back into it, and then you get many more bangs for your buck. And that's a very intentional practice, building up your resources. So you have these internal resources that are really robust so that you have them when you need them. And then there's external resources like your teachers and your mentors and therapists and whatever.
Yeah. Well, you know, the idea of radiating love outward from the heart without restriction, I guess.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, you also share a story about not really being into praying and then realize that your mindfulness meditation was a form of prayer.
For sure.
So tell us about that awareness that you received or you got.
Well, so when you're wishing loving kindness phrases for people and for the planet, that's actually prayer. And mm-hmm. the reason I didn't think that I liked prayer was because of the words in the prayer book. I didn't resonate with the words in the prayer book, and I'm really literal. So now if I'm in a prayer place with other humans, I'll just do my own meditative thought. I mm-hmm. won't delve into what it is that's going on in the prayer book. And then I'm perfectly happy with prayer.
Yeah. Yeah. I, you know, as a recovering Catholic myself, I did the altar boy thing at a young age mm-hmm. in Latin, which I didn't even know what I was saying. You know, I had that objection to some of the words that mm-hmm. were being said and some of the beliefs that just didn't seem right to me. Mm-hmm. And that kind of led my journey to become recovering, you know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it also kind of, you know, centered around prayer, the idea mm-hmm. of prayer. And, you know, recognizing that, you know, prayer does not mean that you are kind of giving in to a particular dogma, but that,
right.
but in fact, you are making a conscious effort to connect to something higher.
Right. Right. It's so interesting, isn't it? Because I don't know if I should even say this. I'm Jewish.
Go ahead, please.
I'm Jewish, and I'm happy and proud to be from that peoplehood, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But right now, because of the war in Israel and Gaza, because of the Hamas atrocities almost 2 years ago on October 7th, and then Israel trying to crush Hamas and obliterating the Gaza Strip in the process, it's very scary mm-hmm. being Jewish, because it's very lonely being Jewish, because Jews are again being almost hunted down. And I feel very unsafe even saying I'm Jewish, which is really sad. I never mm-hmm. thought
yeah.
that in the United States of America, there would be this kind of hatred and violence against a people.
Yeah.
So,
that
really makes me sad.
Yeah, it is, because we should all be able to have our own beliefs of spirituality or not, you know? And,
right, right.
And not be persecuted for those beliefs.
Right. Right. And in America, you know, there's such a range of people in my peoplehood that practice all different ways. I mean, I'm so secular, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm been studying Buddhism for the last 20 years. So it's just really disheartening.
Yeah.
That, you know, something that people that hate what's going on, I hate what's going on. You know, that people that hate what's going on in a democracy on the other side of the earth are getting targeted and harmed here and in Europe. I mean, it's really sad. And so I'm using my MAP method, my mindful self-compassion method, my don't fall out of your window of tolerance method. I'm using all my tools all the time so that I can feel safe and resourced and connected and have a sense of belonging. You know, I'm leaning hard on nature, things that are enduring, rivers, mountains, the beautiful quaking aspen trees where I am right now in Idaho. I'm writing a lot of poetry just to stay in my truth, which is goodness.
Yeah. Now, what do you hope that people are going to take away from reading Snap from Chaos to Calm?
I want people to know that they have a lot of power, that they have a lot of power in their personal choice over their reactions to things. They don't have a lot of power necessarily over what's happening, but of course they do in their reactions. And I want them to be able to use these tools so that they feel better.
Okay, great. Now, I was looking through your website and I noticed you have a podcast called Balanced Mind with Julie Potiker. So can you tell the listeners what they would be able to get from that?
Yeah, so that's free and it's hundreds of guided meditations. They're all loving kindness meditations in some sense or another. And there's a poem at the end. So you'll get introduced to a whole host of phenomenal poets, dead and alive, and also some of my poetry. And I have a debut poetry collection coming out in March. It'll be my 65th birthday, and I'm a new poet. Mm. And the illustrator, there's 25 gorgeous watercolor paintings in there. It'll be his 83rd birthday, Edward Kane.
Wow. You're never too old.
Never. Just keep reinventing yourself, finding your passion and sitting in it and reveling in it.
Exactly. Now, you also have a blog, and the latest post was very good, very interesting. It's called Standing in Awe. This wonderful emotion inspires peace, connection, and creativity. So I'd recommend the listeners go in and pick a read there. And then you also have an area for suggested mindfulness reading. So is that, you know, reading books that you have found particularly helpful in your journey?
Exactly. So it's either my teacher's books or books that I found really useful, even if I never studied with that person. So it's their websites, their books. It's like a library.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's good because I noticed that, you know, sometimes people will listen to a podcast and then want to know more. You know, what else can I, you know, I like this. I want more. So having that as a resource is very useful. And I'm glad that you have it for listeners.
Thanks.
You're welcome. So is there any final message before we close?
No, I just hope people have a blessed day.
Great.
An evening.
Absolutely. Well, I really want to thank you, Julie, for your time and your insight and sharing with us. Very good information that people can use to make their day better. So I want to thank you for that.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for interviewing me.
You're welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Julie Potiker, author of Snap, From Chaos to Calm. And again, you can find out more about the book, this book, as well as all of the other resources we just mentioned by visiting her website, which is www.mindfulmethodsforlife.com. And in closing, I want to thank you all for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.